for the day. It was around 6:30 in the evening, and we'd gone outside. There were cars in the parking lot. I leaned my hands on the roof of one car, and it was very, very warm. Not hot, but nicely warm. I was leaning there, and psst, the red room appeared, and the backward thing appeared, and then some of the dialogue. So I had this idea, these fragments, and I fell in love with them. That's how it starts. The idea tells you to build this red room. So you think about it. Wait a minute, you say. The walls are red, but they're not hard walls. Then you think some more. They're curtains. And they're not opaque. They're translucent. Then you put these curtains there, but the floor, it needs something. And you go back to the idea, and there was something on the floor. It was all there. So you do this thing on the floor, and you start to remember the idea more. You try some things, and you make mistakes, but you rearrange, add other stuff, and then it feels the way the idea felt. Ask the idea. The form which embodies that which appeared in consciousness, that is to be held within consciousness. From the Upanishads. The idea is the whole thing. If you stay true to the idea, it tells you everything you need to know, really. You just keep working to make it look like the idea looked, feel like it felt, sound like it sounded, and be the way it was. And it's weird because when you veer off, you sort of know it. You know when you're doing something that is not correct because it feels incorrect. It says, no, no, this isn't like the idea said it was. And when you're getting into it the correct way, it feels correct. It's an intuition. You feel, think your way through. You start one place, and as you go, it gets more and more finely tuned. But all along, it's the idea talking. At some point, it feels correct to you, and you hope that it feels somewhat correct to others. Sometimes I'll go into a set that was built based on an idea, and for a moment or so, I think I'm right in that idea. It's fantastic. But a lot of times, you don't build a set. You find a location that feels correct based on that idea. And the location can be changed in many ways to get closer to the idea. The props and the light can be altered. The light can play a huge role in this, and you just keep working and working till the thing feels correct, based on the idea. If you pay attention to all the elements swimming together, then lo and behold, at the very end, it's surprising how close it all is to the original spark. New ideas can come along during the process, too. And a film isn't finished until it's finished, so you're always on guard. Sometimes those happy accidents occur. They may even be the last pieces of the puzzle that allow it all to come together, and you feel so thankful. How in the world did this happen? During Blue Velvet, we are shooting a scene in the apartment of the character Ben, who is played by Dean Stockwell. At a certain point, Dean was going to sing In Dreams by Roy Orbison. He was going to lip-sync to that and sing it to Dennis Hopper. In the script, he was supposed to pick up a small lamp from a table and use it as a microphone. But right in front of him on the set, and Patricia Norris, the production designer, said she did not put it there, was this work lamp. It had a long cord, and its bulb was hidden from the audience, but illuminated Dean's face. And Dean just snatched this up. He thought it was placed there for him. And there's so many of these things that come along. Sometimes accidents happen that aren't happy, but you have to work with those as well. You adapt. You throw out this thing, and you throw out that thing, and throw out another thing. But if you pay attention to the original idea, stay true to that, it's surprising how, at the end, even the things that were accidents are honest. They're true to the idea. Test audience. Although you can't make a film with the audience in mind, at a certain point, before it's finished, you need to experience the film with a group. Sometimes you lose your objectivity a little, and you need to get a feel for what's working and what isn't. That can be the worst screening, very close to hell on earth. But again, the film's not finished until it's finished. After you screen it for that group, for the sake of the whole, certain things may have to be cut down, or some things may need to be added. They're not exactly mistakes. Some of the scenes that are removed from a film are kind of nice scenes on their own, but to let the whole thing work, they have to go. It's part of the process. It always happens to some degree. Generalizations. It's dangerous, I think, to say that a woman in a film represents all women or a man in a film represents all men. Some critics love generalizations, but it's that particular character in this particular story going down that particular road. Those specific things make their own world, and sometimes it's a world that we'd like to go into and experience. Darkness. People have asked me why, if meditation is so great and gives you so much bliss, are my films so dark and there's so much violence? There are many, many dark things flowing around in this world now, and most films reflect the world in which we live. They're stories. Stories are always going to have conflict. They're going to have highs and lows and good and bad. I fall in love with certain ideas, and I am where I am. Now, if I told you I was enlightened, and this is enlightened filmmaking, that would be another story. But I'm just a guy from Missoula, Montana, doing my thing, going down the road like everybody else. We all reflect the world we live in. Even if you make a period film, it will reflect your times. You can see the way period films differ depending on when they were made. It's a sensibility, how they talk, certain themes, and those things change as the world changes. And so, even though I'm from Missoula, Montana, which is not the surrealistic capital of the world, you could be anywhere and see a kind of strangeness in how the world is these days, or have a certain way of looking at things. Suffering. It's good for the artist to understand conflict and stress. Those things can give you ideas. But I guarantee you, if you have enough stress, you won't be able to create. And if you have enough conflict, it will just get in the way of your creativity. You can understand conflict, but you don't have to live in it. In stories, in the worlds that we go into, there's suffering, confusion, darkness, tension, and anger. There are murders, there's all kinds of stuff. But the filmmaker doesn't have to be suffering to show suffering. You can show it, show the human condition, show conflicts and contrasts, but you don't have to go through that yourself. You are the orchestrator of it, but you're not in it. Let your characters do the suffering. It's common sense. The more the artist is suffering, the less creative he's going to be. It's less likely he's going to enjoy his work and less likely that he will be able to do really good work. Right here, people might bring up Vincent van Gogh as an example of a painter who did great work in spite of or because of his suffering. I like to think that van Gogh would have been even more prolific and even greater if he wasn't so restricted by the things tormenting him. I don't think it was pain that made him so great. I think his painting brought him whatever happiness he had. Some artists believe that anger, depression, or these negative things give them an edge. They think they need to hold on to that anger and fear so they can put it in their work. And they don't like the idea of getting happy. It makes them want to puke. They think it would make them lose their edge or their power. But you will not lose your edge if you meditate. You will not lose your creativity. And you will not lose your power. In fact, the more you meditate and transcend, the more those things will grow and you'll know it. You will gain far more understanding of all aspects of life when you dive within. And that way, understanding grows, appreciation grows, the bigger picture forms, and the human condition becomes more and more visible. If you're an artist, you've got to know about anger without being restricted by it. In order to create, you've got to have energy. You've got to have clarity. You've got to be able to catch ideas. You've got to be strong enough to fight unbelievable pressure and stress in this world. So it just makes sense to nurture the place where that strength and clarity and energy come from, to dive in and enliven that. It's a strange thing, but it's true in my experience. Bliss is like a flak jacket. It's a protecting thing. If you have enough bliss, it's invincibility. And when these negative things start lifting, you can catch more ideas and see them with greater understanding. You can get fired up more easily. You've got more energy, more clarity. Then you can really go to work and translate those ideas into one medium or another. Light of the Self. He who sees everything as nothing but the self, and the self in everything he sees, such a seer withdraws from nothing. For the enlightened, all that exists is nothing but the self. So how could any suffering or delusion continue for those who know this oneness? from the Upanishads. Negativity is like darkness. So what is darkness? You look at darkness and you see that it's really nothing. It's the absence of something. You turn on the light and darkness goes. But sunlight, for instance, doesn't get rid of negativity. It gets rid of darkness, but not negativity. So what light can you turn on that removes negativity the way sunlight removes darkness? It's the light of pure consciousness, the self, the light of unity. Don't fight the darkness. Don't even worry about the darkness. Turn on the light and the darkness goes. Turn up that light of pure consciousness. Negativity goes. Now you say, that sounds so sweet. It sounds too sweet. But it's a real thing. A tower of gold. Just as a mirror shines bright once it has been cleaned of dust, so those who have seen the self shine in mind and body. They are always and forever filled with happiness. From the Upanishads. How does meditation get rid of negativity? Picture it this way. You are the Empire State Building. You've got hundreds of rooms, and in those rooms, there's lots of junk, and you put all that junk there. Now you take this elevator, which is going to be the dive within, and you go down below the building. You go to the unified field beneath the building, pure consciousness, and it's like electric gold. You experience that, and that electric gold activates these little cleaning robots. They start going, and they start cleaning the rooms. They put in gold where the dirt and junk and garbage were. These stresses that were in there like coils of barbed wire can unwind. They evaporate. They come out. You're cleaning and infusing simultaneously. You're on the road to a beautiful state of enlightenment. Religion. I was raised Presbyterian. I respect people who are religious, and I think they find something there that's beautiful, just beautiful. There's truth there. Because these religions are old, though, and they've been fiddled with, possibly, I feel some of the original keys from the masters have been lost. But we're all going to the same beautiful goal. That's the way I see it. All religions flow ultimately to the one ocean. Transcendental meditation is a technique to experience that ocean, and it's a technique practiced by people from all religions. Transcendental meditation itself is not a religion. It's not against any religion. It's not against anything. Drugs. We all want expanded consciousness and bliss. It's a natural human desire, and a lot of people look for it in drugs. But the problem is that the body, the physiology, takes a hard hit on drugs. Drugs injure the nervous system, so they just make it harder to get those experiences on your own. I have smoked marijuana, but I no longer do. I went to art school in the 60s, so you can imagine what was going on. Yet my friends were the ones who said, "No, no, no, David, don't you take those drugs." I was pretty lucky. Besides, far more profound experiences are available naturally. When your consciousness starts expanding, those experiences are there. All those things can be seen. It's just a matter of expanding that ball of consciousness. And the ball of consciousness can expand to be infinite and unbounded. It's totality. You can have totality. So all those experiences are there for you without the side effects of drugs. Turn on the light. In the vicinity of yoga, unity, hostile tendencies are eliminated. From the Yoga Sutras. We're like light bulbs. If bliss starts growing inside you, it's like a light. It affects the environment. If you go into a room where someone's been having a big argument, it's not so pleasant. You can feel it. Even if the argument's over, you can feel it. But if you go into a room where someone has just finished meditating, you can feel that bliss. It's very nice to feel that. We all affect our environments. You enjoy that light inside, and if you ramp it up brighter and brighter, you enjoy more and more of it. And that light will extend out farther and farther. Industrial Symphony No. 1. Industrial Symphony No. 1 was the first and only time I've done a stage production. It was at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. We had 2 weeks to set it up, but only one day in the actual theater to put it all together and do two performances. I was working on the music with Angelo Badalamenti, and we were attempting some abstract musical things to tie different elements together. I had some people building sets, but from the time the sets went up, the whole thing had to be rehearsed and lit in one day. So the day came, and we had the late morning and afternoon to rehearse and then put on two shows. I wanted to start rehearsing from the beginning, to rehearse all the way through. We started, and about an hour and a half later, I'd hardly even gotten into the thing, even though it wasn't very long, and I realized that I was facing a gigantic, definite disaster. I thought, I'm never going to make it unless I get some kind of idea, and bingo, it happened. Maybe it's not reinventing the wheel, perhaps it's just common sense, but what I did was I went one by one. I would grab this person and say, do you see that over there? When that man there goes there and then leaves, then you go there. And he'd say, okay. And when you get there, you do this, this, and this. Okay. Then I'd go to the next person. I'd say, do you see that man there? When he does this, this, and this, then it's your cue to go over here and you do that, that, and that. We never had a rehearsal, but fortunately it all worked out. Lost Highway. At the time that Barry Gifford and I were writing the script for Lost Highway, I was sort of obsessed with the O.J. Simpson trial. Barry and I never talked about it this way, but I think the film is somehow related to that. What struck me about O.J. Simpson was that he was able to smile and laugh. He was able to go golfing later with seemingly very few problems about the whole thing. I wondered how, if a person did these deeds, he could go on living. And we found this great psychology term, psychogenic fugue, describing an event where the mind tricks itself to escape some horror. So in a way, Lost Highway is about that, and also the fact that nothing can stay hidden forever. Restrictions. Sometimes restrictions get the mind going. If you've got tons and tons of money, you may relax and figure you can throw money at any problem that comes along. You don't have to think so hard, but when you have limitations, sometimes you come up with very creative, inexpensive ideas. My friend Gary D'Amico is a special effects man, and he loves to blow things up. He's the one who blew up the house in Lost Highway, and he didn't have the stuff to do it. I didn't even know I was going to blow up that house. The production manager asked, "Are we going to tear the house down? You want to save any of this stuff?" And I said, "Tear it down," and I started thinking. I went to Gary and said, "What if I wanted to blow up something?" His face lit up, and I said, "I want to blow up this house." And he said, "Oh, I wish you would have told me. I don't know what I've got." But then he said, "Yeah, yeah, we can do it." And so he went in and wired up this thing with everything he had, and it was the most beautiful sight. If he had brought in what he would have, had he known in advance, it wouldn't have been as beautiful. It was a soft explosion. It sent the stuff for hundreds of feet, but softly. And then we shot it backward, so it turned out incredible. Mulholland Drive. Mulholland Drive was originally going to be a continuing story on television. We shot it as a pilot, open-ended, to make you want to see more and more. I heard that the man at ABC who was making the decision whether to accept the pilot or not saw it at 6 a.m. He was watching television across the room while having some coffee and making some phone calls, and he hated what he saw. It bored him, so he turned it down. Then I had the chance, fortunately, to make it into a feature, but I didn't have the ideas. Now, you don't use meditation to catch ideas. You're expanding the container, and you come out very refreshed, filled with energy, and raring to go and catch ideas afterward. But in this particular case, almost the day I got the go-ahead to turn it into a feature, I went into meditation, and somewhere about 10 minutes in, there it was. Like a string of pearls, the ideas came, and they affected the middle, the beginning, and the end. I felt very blessed. But that's the only time it's happened during meditation. The box and the key. I don't have a clue what those are. A sense of place. A sense of place is so critical in cinema because you want to go into another world. Every story has its own world and its own feel and its own mood. So you try to put together all these things, these little details, to create that sense of place. It has a lot to do with lighting and sound. The sounds that come into a room can help paint a world there and make it so much fuller. While many sets are good enough for a wide shot, in my mind they should be good enough for close scrutiny, for the little details to show. You may not ever really see them all, but you've got to feel that they're there somehow, to feel that it's a real place, a real world. Beauty. When you see an aging building or a rusted bridge, you are seeing nature and man working together. If you paint over a building, there's no more magic to that building. But if it's allowed to age, then man has built it and nature has added into it. It's so organic. But often people wouldn't think to permit that, except for scenic designers. Texture. I don't necessarily love rotting bodies, but there's a texture to a rotting body that is unbelievable. Have you ever seen a little rotted animal? I love looking at those things, just as much as I like to look at a close-up of some tree bark, or a small bug, or a cup of coffee, or a piece of pie. You get in close and the textures are wonderful. Working with wood. Wood is one of the greatest materials to work with. There are soft woods and hard woods, and they all have their own beauty when you are working with them. When I saw through a piece of freshly cut pine, the smell of it just sends me right to heaven. The same goes even for pine needles. I used to chew ponderosa pine pitch, which is the sap that oozes out of the tree and dries on the outside of the bark. If you get a fresh piece of pitch, it is like syrup. It will stick to you, and you won't be able to get it off your hands. But sometimes it hardens like old honey, and you can chew this, and the flavor of pine pitch will make you crazy in a good way. Pine, being a softer wood, is easier to work with and is readily available. When I was young, I did a lot of things with pine, but then I started falling in love with Douglas fir, vertical grain Douglas fir. When you varnish a piece of Douglas fir, it has a depth of beauty that is just phenomenal. And then, when you put two pieces of wood together, you start realizing there are so many possibilities, and you learn some tricks along the way. And then there's Gunter, a German carpenter who didn't use electric tools at all. He would just come up to the house with a set of hand tools in a beautiful wooden box with a handle, which he'd carry around. And Gunter, I'd watch this man, did little detail work on Douglas fir. He would put these two pieces of wood together, and then he'd rub his old battered thumbs against the seam, and the seam would disappear. It was like a magic act. The pieces fit so perfectly. Gunter was a real carpenter. Having a setup. Some mornings, in a perfect world, you might wake up, have a coffee, finish meditation, and say, "Okay, today I'm going into the shop to work on a lamp." This idea comes to you. You can see it, but to accomplish it, you need what I call a setup. For example, you may need a working shop or a working painting studio. You may need a working music studio or a computer room where you can write something. It's crucial to have a setup so that at any given moment when you get an idea, you have the place and the tools to make it happen. If you don't have a setup, there are many times when you get the inspiration, the idea, but you have no tools, no place to put it together, and the idea just sits there and festers. Over time, it will go away. You didn't fulfill it, and that's just a heartache. Fire. Sitting in front of a fire is mesmerizing. It's magical. I feel the same way about electricity and smoke and flickering lights. Light on film. Often in a scene, the room and the light together signify a mood. So even if the room isn't perfect, you can work with the light and get it to feel correct, so that it has the mood that came with the original idea. The light can make all the difference in a film, even in a character. I love seeing people come out of darkness. The straight story. I didn't write the straight story. It was something of a departure for me because it's completely linear. But then I fell in love with the emotion of the script. So you can fall in love with something that already exists too, and it's similar to falling in love with an idea. You get that feeling of what it could be on film, and that guides you. Heroes of film. I'm a huge admirer of Billy Wilder. There are two films of his that I most love because they create such a world of their own, Sunset Boulevard and The Apartment. And then there's Fellini, who is a tremendous inspiration. I like La Strada and 8 and a Half, but really all of them, and again, for the world and the characters and the mood, and for this level which you can't put your finger on that comes out of each one. I love Hitchcock. Rear Window is a film that makes me crazy in a good way. There's such a coziness with James Stewart in one room, and it's such a cool room, and the people who come into this room, Grace Kelly, for instance, and Thelma Ritter, it's just so fantastic that they're all in on a mystery that's unfolding out their window. It's magical, and everybody who sees it feels that. It's so nice to go back and visit that place. Fellini. I was shooting a commercial in Rome and was working with two people who had worked with Fellini. He was in a hospital in northern Italy, but we heard he was being moved down to Rome. So I said, "Do you think it'd be possible to go over and say hello to him?" And they said, "Yeah, we'll try to arrange that." There was an attempt on a Thursday night that fell through, but Friday night we went over. It was about 6 o'clock in the evening in summer, a beautiful warm evening. Two of us went in and were taken into Fellini's room. There was another man in the room, and my friend knew him, so we went over and talked to him. Fellini had me sit down. He was in a little wheelchair between two beds, and he took my hand, and we sat and talked for a half an hour. I don't think I asked him much. I just listened a lot. He talked about the old days, how things were. He told stories. I really liked sitting near him. And then we left. That was Friday night, and Sunday he went into a coma and never came out. Kubrick. Stanley Kubrick is one of my all-time favorite filmmakers, and he did me a great honor early in my career that really encouraged me. I was working on The Elephant Man and was at Lee International Studios in England, standing in a hallway. One of the producers of The Elephant Man, Jonathan Sanger, brought over some guys who were working with George Lucas and said, "They've got a story for you." And I said, "Okay." They said, "Yesterday, David, we were out at Elstree Studios and we met Kubrick. And as we were talking to him, he said to us, 'How would you fellas like to come up to my house tonight and see my favorite film?' They said, 'That would be fantastic.' They went up and Stanley Kubrick showed them Eraserhead. So right then, I could have passed away peaceful and happy. I like all of Kubrick's films, but my favorite may be Lolita. I just like the world. I like the characters. I love the performances. James Mason is phenomenal beyond the beyond in this film." Inland Empire. "We are like the spider. We weave our life and then move along in it. We are like the dreamer who dreams and then lives in the dream. This is true for the entire universe." From the Upanishads. When we began, there wasn't any Inland Empire. There wasn't anything. I just bumped into Laura Dern on the street, discovering that she was my new neighbor. I hadn't seen her for a long time, and she said, "David, we've got to do something together again." And I said, "We sure do. Maybe I'll write something for you, and maybe we'll do it as an experiment for the internet." And she said, "Fine." So I wrote a 14-page monologue, and Laura memorized all 14 pages, and it was about a 70-minute take, and she was so phenomenal. I couldn't release it on the internet because it was too good, and it drove me crazy because there was something about this that held a secret for more. And I would ponder over this thing, and something more would emerge, and that would lead to another scene, but I wouldn't know what in the world it was, and it didn't really make much sense. But then another idea would come for another scene, and maybe this one, the third one, was very far removed from the first two, even though the second was quite a jump from the first. One day we were getting ready to shoot a scene called The Little House, which involved Laura and my friend Krzysztof, an actor from Poland. Krzysztof arrived in Los Angeles fresh from Poland, and the Camera Image gang brought him over to my house. When he got out of the car, he was wearing these goofy glasses, and he smiled and pointed to the glasses. So I got the idea that he planned to wear these things in the scene, and I said, "No, no, no, Christoph." And he said, "I need a prop. I need a thing." So I went into my office and opened up the cupboard and saw a little piece of broken tile. I saw a rock, and I saw a red light bulb, but very transparent like a Christmas light. I took these things out and offered him a choice. "Take one of these, Christoph." And he picked up the bulb. I put the other things away. I wasn't going to let him have those anymore. I just gave him the bulb. So we went out to the small house, and Christoph came out from behind a tree with the red bulb in his mouth. And that's how we shot the scene. So one thing led to another. I really had this feeling that if there's a unified field, there must be a unity between a Christmas tree bulb and this man from Poland who came in wearing these strange glasses. It's interesting to see how these unrelated things live together, and it gets your mind working. How do these things relate when they seem so far apart? It conjures up a third thing that almost unifies those first two. It's a struggle to see how this unity in the midst of diversity could go to work. The ocean is the unity, and these things float on it. And I thought, well, obviously, there's got to be a way that these relate because of this great unified field. There couldn't be a fragment that doesn't relate to everything. It's all kind of one thing, I felt. So I had high hopes that there would be a unity emerging, that I would see the way things all related one to another. But it wasn't until halfway through that suddenly I saw a kind of form that would unite the rest, everything that had come before. And that was a big day. That was a good day because I could pretty much say that it would be a feature film. The name. One day, still very early in the process, I was talking to Laura Dern and learned that her now husband, Ben Harper, is from the Inland Empire in Los Angeles. We were talking along and she mentioned that. I don't know when it popped up, but I said, "That is the title of this film." I knew nothing about the film at the time, but I wanted to call it Inland Empire. My parents have a log cabin up in Montana, and my brother, cleaning up there one day, found a scrapbook behind a dresser. He sent it to me because it was my little scrapbook from when I was 5 years old, from when I lived in Spokane, Washington. I opened up this scrapbook, and the first picture in it was an aerial view of Spokane, and underneath it said, Inland Empire. So I figured I was on the right track. A new way to work. Working on Inland Empire was very different. We shot it entirely in digital video, so the level of flexibility and control was amazing. Also, I didn't have a script. I wrote the thing scene by scene without much of a clue where it would end. It was a risk, but I had this feeling that because all things are unified, this idea over here would somehow relate to that idea over there. And I was working with a very great company, Studio Canal in France, who believed in me enough to let me find my way. Director's Commentary. I don't do director's commentary tracks in my DVD releases. I know people enjoy extras, but now, with all the add-ons, the film just seems to have gotten lost. We've got to guard the film itself. It should stand alone. You work so hard to get a film a certain way. It shouldn't be fiddled with. Director's commentaries just open a door to changing people's take on the number one thing, the film. I do believe in telling stories surrounding a film, but to comment as it's rolling is a sacrilege. Instead, I think you should try to see the whole film through and try to see it in a quiet place, on as big a screen as you can, with as good a sound system as you can. Then you can go into that world and have that experience. The death of film. I'm through with film as a medium. For me, film is dead. If you look at what people all over the world are taking still pictures with now, you begin to see what's going to happen. I'm shooting in digital video, and I love it. I have a website, and I started doing small experiments for the site with these small cameras. At first thinking they were just like little toys, and they were not very good. But then I started realizing that they're very, very good, for me at least. You have 40-minute takes, automatic focus. They're lightweight, and you can see what you've shot right away. With film, you have to go into the lab and you don't see what you've shot until the next day. But with DV, as soon as you're done, you can put it into the computer and go right to work. And there are so many tools. 1,000 tools were born this morning, and there'll be 10,000 new tools tomorrow. It happened first in sound. Now everybody's got Pro Tools, and you can manipulate these sounds, just fine-tune them unbelievably fast. The same thing is going to happen with the image. It gives you so much control. I started thinking and experimenting. I did some tests from DV to film, because you still have to transfer to film to show in the theater. And although it does not look exactly like it was shot on film, it looks way better than I would have thought. Once you start working in that world of DV with small, lightweight equipment and automatic focus, working with film seems so cumbersome. These 35mm film cameras are starting to look like dinosaurs to me. They're huge, they weigh tons, and you've got to move them around, and there are so many things that have to be done, and it's all so slow. It kills a lot of possibilities. With DV, everything is lighter, you're more mobile, it's far more fluid, you can think on your feet and catch things. And for actors, to get down into a character in the middle of a scene and then suddenly have to stop while we reload the film cameras after 10 minutes, often this breaks the thing. But now you're rolling along. You've got 40 minutes down in there. And you can start talking to the actors. Instead of stopping, you can move in and push it. You can even rehearse while you're shooting. Although I start goofing up the soundtrack because they've got to chop out all my words. But many times I am talking to the actors while we are shooting, and we are able to get in deeper and deeper. DV for young filmmakers. My advice is to use the opportunity DV brings to do what you truly believe in. Keep your own voice. Don't do anything for the sole purpose of impressing any studio or some money people. That always seems to backfire in my experience. It's great to go to film school, and you can get a lot of intellectual knowledge there, but learn by doing. And now that costs have fallen, you can really go and do it on your own. Then there are lots of film festivals that you can enter and see if you can catch some distribution or financial help later on. DV quality. The DV camera I currently use is a Sony PD150, which is lower quality than HD, and I love this lower quality. I love the small cameras. The quality reminds me of the films of the 1930s. In the early days, the emulsion wasn't so good, so there was less information on the screen. The Sony PD result is a bit like that. It's nowhere near high def. And sometimes, in a frame, if there's some question about what you're seeing or some dark corner, the mind can go dreaming. If everything is crystal clear in the frame, that's what it is. That's all it is. And high def, unfortunately, is so crystal clear. I saw a piece of film on the screen in my mixing room shot in high def. It was some kind of science fiction, and in the background I could see wood screws in what was supposed to be a metal console. It's going to be far more difficult to build sets for high def. Future of cinema. How we see films is changing. The video iPod and videos online are changing everything. A tiny little picture instead of a giant big picture is going to be how people see films. And the good news, at least people will have their headphones. Sound will become, I think, even more important. But then maybe you can put the iPod in something and squirt the image on a big screen in your home. Have subwoofers and beautiful speaker systems and quietness in the house so that you can fall into this world. The whole thing is, when those curtains open and the lights go down, we must be able to go into that world. And in many ways, it's getting very difficult to go into a world. People talk so much in theaters, and there's a tiny, crummy little picture. How do you get that experience? I think it's going to be a bit of a bumpy road. But the possibility is there for very clean pictures. No scratches, no dirt, no watermarks, no tearing, and an image that can be controlled in an infinite number of ways. If you take care of how you show a film, it can be a beautiful experience that lets you go into a world. We're still working out ways for that to happen, but digital is here, the video iPod is here, and we've just got to get real and roll with the flow. Common sense. Most of filmmaking is common sense. If you stay on your toes and think about how to do a thing, it's right there. advice. The truth upholds the fragment earth and makes the living water wet. Truth makes fire burn and the air move, makes the sun shine and all life grow. A hidden truth supports everything. Find it and win. Ramayana. Stay true to yourself. Let your voice ring out, and don't let anybody fiddle with it. Never turn down a good idea, but never take a bad idea. And meditate. It's very important to experience that self, that pure consciousness. It's really helped me. I think it would help any filmmaker. So start diving within, enlivening that bliss consciousness. Grow in happiness and intuition. Experience the joy of doing, and you'll glow in this peaceful way. Your friends will be very, very happy with you. Everyone will want to sit next to you, and people will give you money. Sleep. Sleep is really important. You need to rest the physiology to be able to work well and meditate well. When I don't get enough sleep, my meditations are duller. You may even dip into sleep at the beginning of your meditation because you're settling down. But if you're well rested, you'll have a clearer, deeper experience. Maybe even in a sleepy meditation, you're transcending a little, but it's far better to have a very clear, clean system as you go in. And when you dive, it's very powerful, very deep. When you meditate, the mind settles down to that deepest level, and the physiology settles down right behind it. And now, through lots of research, they know that in that deepest state in meditation, you're getting 3 times deeper rest than that of the deepest sleep. Still, sleep is important to prepare you to get to that level. Keep at it. It's such a tricky business. You want to do your art, but you've got to live. So you've got to have a job, and then sometimes you're too tired to do your art. But if you love what you're doing, you're going to keep on doing it anyway. I've been very lucky. Along the way, there are people who help us. I've had plenty of those people in my life who've helped me go to the next step. And you get that help because you've done something, so you have to keep doing it. So much of what happened to me is good fortune, but I would say try to get a job that gives you some time. Get your sleep and a little bit of food and work as much as you can. There's so much enjoyment in doing what you love. Maybe this will open doors and you'll find a way to do what you love. I hope you do. Success and failure. In some ways, the more films you've done, the easier it is to make one. You become familiar with the process of catching an idea and translating that idea. You understand the tools and the lighting. You understand the whole process. You've been through it before. But it's also harder, because when you release another film, it's seen in context of what you've already done. It's going to be judged based on that. And if you've just come off something successful, you feel that you may take the fall. But if you've come down from something very low, as I did after Dune, there may be zero fear. You feel you can't get any lower. You may experience this euphoria and freedom that you have nothing to lose. You have to learn to find balance in success and failure. Success can kill you just as failure can. And the only way to have balance in success and failure is to function on that unified field level. There's your friend. You can't fake it. You're either in that field or you're not. And when that field is fully enlivened, you can't lose no matter what happens. Gone fishing again. Curving back upon my own nature, I create again and again. Bhagavad Gita. When you finish a project, there's a good feeling to it, but there's something of a vacuum too. You've been putting all your attention on that, and then it's done. It's like fishing. You caught a beautiful fish yesterday, and you're out today with the same bait, and you're wondering if you're going to catch another. But if you carry on the analogy of fishing, sometimes, even if you sit with lots and lots of patience, no fish come. You're in the wrong area. And so maybe you reel in the hook, get the paddle, and move to another place. That means you leave the chair where you're daydreaming, or you move on to another thing. Just by changing something, the desire often gets fulfilled. It doesn't mean that if you just sit and wait that it will come. I don't know quite what brings it, but the desire, if it's kept alive, will often be validated with an idea. When you get an idea, you know you've got a validation. Compassion. Softer than the flower where kindness is concerned, stronger than the thunder where principles are at stake. Vedic definition of the enlightened. Meditation is not a selfish thing. Even though you're diving in and experience the self, you're not closing yourself off from the world. You're strengthening yourself so that you can be more effective when you go back out into the world. It's like they say on airplanes, first put your mask on and then help those next to you put theirs on. My friend Charlie Lutz used to say, there's a guy crying on the curb and you sit down to comfort him and pretty soon there's two guys crying on the curb. So compassion, appreciation for others, and the capacity to help others are enhanced when you meditate. You start diving down and experiencing this ocean of pure love, pure peace. You could say pure compassion. You experience that and know it by being it. Then you go out into the world and you can really do something for people. Consciousness-based education. One of the main things that got me talking publicly about transcendental meditation was seeing the difference it can make to kids. Kids are suffering. Stress is now hitting them at a younger and younger age, at just about the time they get out of the crib. And there are all these different learning disorders that I never even heard about before. At the same time, I saw the results of consciousness-based education, which is education that develops the full potential of the human being. It's the same education everyone receives, with the added bonus that the student learns to dive within and unfold that self, that pure consciousness. There's a school principal, Dr. George Rutherford in Washington, D.C., who has introduced transcendental meditation into three schools. Before that, the schools were filled with violence. There were shootings, suicide, and violence. But he got the staff meditating, got the teachers meditating, got the students meditating, and watched it all turn around. There's another principal, Carmen Anamdi in Detroit, who introduced transcendental meditation in her school about 9 years ago. The kids meditate 10 minutes in the morning together, 10 minutes in the afternoon, and the school is a blissful school. Those kids are happier, getting better grades, and going out and experiencing all kinds of success. It's something that works. You take in more intellectual knowledge during school because it's so much fun, but you're also expanding the container of that knowledge. You contrast that with what normal education produces, which is a joke. It's facts and figures, but the knower does not know him or herself. One night I saw a play at Maharishi School in Iowa, a school that has consciousness-based education. It was a cold and rainy night, and when I was told I was going to see a high school play, I thought, man, it's going to be a very long night. I was in the middle of this little theater, a beautiful little theater, and out on stage came the students. They weren't professional actors. They were just kids putting on a play. But I was never more blown away. I thought it was better than a Broadway production because what I saw was consciousness on these faces. A lively, glowing consciousness. They had such intelligence and timing, and their humor was right on the money. You don't worry about students like that. They're self-sufficient. They're going to do fine in the world, and they're going to make the world better by being in it. My foundation, the David Lynch Foundation for Consciousness-Based Education and World Peace, was set up to help more kids get that kind of experience. We've raised money and given it to schools all over the country for thousands and thousands of students to learn to meditate. And it's amazing to see kids who do this. Stress just doesn't catch them. It's like water off a duck's back. I want to do this not only for those students' sake, for their own growth of consciousness, but for all of us, because we are like light bulbs. And, like light bulbs, we can enjoy that brighter light of consciousness within and also radiate it. I believe that the key to peace is in this. If there were 10,000 new meditating students, it would affect this country. It would be like a wave of peace. It's harmony, coherence, real peace. In the individual, the light of consciousness drives negativity further and further away. In the world, it can do the same thing. Real peace. Avert the danger that has not yet come. Yoga Sutras. People are so convinced we can't have peace that it's a joke now. Somebody wins a beauty pageant and the joke is she wants world peace. And everybody has a big laugh. Nobody believes in peace. It's a nice idea, but that's all it is. Just a sweet little old lady idea. It's meaningless. It's never going to happen. And we live in this hellhole, and we think it's got to be this way. But what if we're wrong? We know that in one human being, when you ramp up consciousness, when you ramp up that light of unity, negative things begin to recede. In that individual, you see more and more intelligence, more and more creativity, more and more bliss, negativity going away, and a positive influence pouring out into the world. So if there were many, many meditators, it would be beautiful. But even without that, small groups of advanced meditators could still make a huge difference. The theory is that if the square root of 1% of the world's population, or 8,000 people, practices advanced meditation techniques in a group, then that group, according to published research, is quadratically more powerful than the same number scattered about. These peace-creating groups have been formed for short-term studies, and every time the advanced meditators got together in a group, they dramatically affected the area around them. They measurably reduced crime and violence. How did they do that? There is a field of unity within everyone. It's always been there. It's unbounded, infinite, and eternal. It's that level of life that never had a beginning. It is, and it will be, forever. And it can be enlivened. In the human being, the enlivening of that field leads to enlightenment, the full potential of the individual. In the world, the result of enlivening unity by a peace-creating group would be real peace on earth. In closing, I'd like to say I deeply love film. I love catching ideas, and I love to meditate. I love enlivening unity, and I think the enlivening of unity brings a better and better life. Maybe enlightenment is far away, but it's said that when you walk toward the light, with every step, things get brighter. Every day for me gets better and better, and I believe that enlivening unity in the world will bring peace on earth. So I say peace to all of you. May everyone be happy. May everyone be free of disease. May auspiciousness be seen everywhere. May suffering belong to no one. Peace. This is David Lynch. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Catching the Big Fish. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced and directed by Kevin Thompson. Catching the Big Fish is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA Incorporated. Copyright 2006. All rights reserved. The book, Catching the Big Fish, is available wherever Jeremy P. Tarcher Penguin books are sold.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.